Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we've got a history feel on today's show. Our studio guest is Kelsey Wilson-Lee, talking about her book Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I. We'll also hear from Jonathan Fennell on his book about the British and Commonwealth armies and the Second World War. And Cathy Moore, director of the Cambridge Literary Festival, tells us what's coming up in this year's festival. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me, Lee.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But as I say, a history feel to this week's show. Was it always going to be history for you?
Well, actually, it was originally going to be, I wanted to be an astronaut until I was about 20 years old, when I was forced to give that dream up, realizing that tragically my maths really weren't up to it. But I've always loved history, and particularly I've always loved objects. I was that slightly strange child wandering around antique stores as a young person, and digging into the curio cabinets of elderly relatives and demanding that they, tell me the story of this object and that object and whose was it and what did it do? What did it mean? And so I've always kind of been drawn to things from the past, buildings and books and images and indeed kind of real objects, things that people had and treasured, because I think they're kind of interesting. They can tell you stories.
Yes, your academic speciality is medieval material culture, so that's what that means, is it?
That's right. Yes, material culture is a kind of academic speak for stuff that survives, and my academic work was largely on stuff in churches, so stained glass or sculpture that. Either decorative sculpture or in particular, commemorative sculpture, great effigies of knights lying around for centuries.
And it's particularly British history that you're interested in, and we can tell by your accent that you're not from around these parts, as they say. So you're American?
I am indeed. So my family are from the American South, from Tennessee, and I think my parents were Anglophiles, probably, from early in my childhood. So I grew up watching Poirot and Miss Marple and things like that. So I became interested predominantly in British history, really as a teenager. And it was really, I was drawn to medieval England. And I had a wonderful history teacher who handed me a book at the age of 14 and said, I think you might like this. And she was right. I did. It wasn't a history book. It was historical fiction. It was a book called Catherine by an author called Anya Seton. And it was written in the 1950s. And it's a bit bodice rippy, actually, but a really evocative description of the 14th century in England. And I was hooked.
Yes, why medieval history?
Oh, well, what's not to like? I mean, it's got war and plague and lots of exciting adventures. But it's different enough to seem kind of a bit exotic, but accessible enough because you can still see it everywhere. I mean, one of the reasons I love living in Britain so much. I've been here now for going on, I think it's going to be 18 years soon. And one of the things I've never fallen out of love with is you can go to any little village anywhere in Britain, and right in the middle of the village is an 800-year-old church. And you can just walk right into it. That doesn't exist in Tennessee. You can just walk right into these gorgeous buildings, and inside them are countless stories. You see these tombs on the wall or on the floor, the stained glass that someone has put there hundreds of years ago, thinking that this will last forever. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about the churches as spaces, is that these are people's description of themselves or their hope for how they might be remembered forever. And it's still there and you can see it. And I think that's pretty special.
Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, Kelsey, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Entre Ave, Ava, I think that's how you pronounce it, by Barbara Kabakova from the I'm going to get all tied up, so you tie.
The Cantigas de Santa Maria.
And why this one?
So this is one of the songs that was written by a poet king in Spain who happened to be the uncle of the people my book is about.
That's Entre Ave, Ava from the Cantiga de Santa Maria, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Kelsey Wilson-Lee. Kelsey is an historian of Britain, its art and its architecture. She's a doctor in medieval history and has published widely on her academic speciality of medieval material culture, writing on tombs, churches and stained glass. Her first book, Daughters of Chivalry, explores what it was really like to be a princess during the age of chivalry in a vibrant account of the five daughters of Edward I. Tracy Borman, the author of The Private Lives of the Tudors and Thomas Cromwell, described it as a stunning and intricately researched portrayal of five extraordinary women whose stories have until now remained in the shadows. The author shatters many of the myths surrounding the lives of medieval princesses and brings them to life in all their startling modernity. Well, Kelsey, I'll come back to that quote because there was a few things I want to pick up on there. But this is your first book. So why this subject for your first book?
Yeah, I think that I in my academic research, I came across a lot of instances of women in the medieval period who were representing themselves on a seal, that was used to kind of sign letters or documents, or on tombs or in stained glass, where they were presenting themselves very differently than the common perception of women in the distant past. I think there is a common notion that we have in society that women in the past didn't have the power to determine the course of their own lives. They didn't have ability to kind of do a number of the different kind of things that we consider free choices. And strikingly, elite women really did. They didn't. They certainly, I don't want to say in any way that this was not a patriarchal culture. It was a hideously patriarchal culture. There was a lot of deep misogyny in the belief system. And there was also a lot of kind of codified legal inhibitions against women owning property and things like this. But for elite women, the opportunity was there to be influential and to have quite a lot of power and quite a lot of ability to determine the course of their own existence. And I think that that's a story that is not as well understood as it should be. I think the individuals here who I've written about had startlingly interesting lives, exceptionally interesting lives, but also surprisingly interesting lives. And I think that these are stories that kind of deserve to be better known.
It's a fascinating book. And this startling modernity that Tracy Borman quotes as saying, you know, brings them to life in all their startling modernity. They do feel very modern women.
Yes. I mean, I think, well, I tend to think that people are more common than we would perceive. There's a notion, I think, that people before the Reformation were kind of different in a fundamental way. And in some ways, they were. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that people in the medieval period believed fundamentally different things than anyone after the advent of, you know, the scientific method or the Enlightenment would conceive of the world. But there are also things that are universal to people. And I think there are wonderful instances in here where you can see teenagers behaving like teenagers. And you can see kind of, you know, tantrums being thrown. And it feels very, but it feels accessible and it feels like you can relate to these people. And one of the things I want to do with this book is encourage people to be open to the idea of being interested in medieval history and not seeing it as too different and inaccessible.
And it's called The Daughters of Chivalry because you can't really take away the fact that this was the age of chivalry. Let's set the scene a little bit. What does that mean, the age of chivalry?
So chivalry was a kind of cultural notion that governed social interaction in the, really from the late 12th, early 13th century. It came out of France originally, and it spread all over Western Europe. And this is obviously the age of knights and ladies and tournaments and great fanfare and all of that. But really it was a kind of codified mode of interacting between elite people. And it involved poetry, it involved song, it involved quite a lot of what we would now term performance, where people are kind of enacting, they're interacting in a pre kind of arranged manner, and together, and by doing that interacting, the knight bows before the lady. The lady bestows her favor. By doing that, they're reinforcing their kind of shared cultural bond, and this really did bring Western Europe culturally very close together during this time. England, France, parts of, you know, Germany and Spain were kind of brought together in this shared cultural tradition.
And their princesses, their father, Edward I, he was a solid, well-liked monarch.
He was an extremely popular monarch in his time. Probably not a very nice man. He doesn't...
What makes you say that?
He doesn't... Well, he has a number of a significant number of sins to account for based on our modern perception. He very famously expelled the entire Jewish population of the country, largely as a means of both making money, in that he captured all of their wealth, and he also he knew it would be popular with his a lot of people owed a lot of interest to Jewish lenders, so in all of those debts were erased. So he knew this would be very popular, but obviously a pretty appalling thing to do. He went on crusades and was a big fan of that. He did have, I mean, he had a, he's not, he doesn't necessarily match our modern notion of a great guy, but he was a wonderfully successful and medieval king because he was strong, he was a great warrior, he was pious, he was successful fundamentally. I mean, he was, this is the hammer of the Scots, right? He conquered Wales. He, at least during his life, he never quite conquered Scotland, but he had a number of pretty good goes. And he, you know, he was out constantly battling in the continent as well. So he was considered very much the kind of the flower of chivalry on his death. So he was a great king, and actually a pretty interestingly, I think actually probably a pretty good father to most of his children.
And he had a loving marriage, it would seem, to Eleanor of Castile. She died. Mm. So what effect did not having a mother have on the daughters, do you think?
So I think that's really interesting. And because we've got the spread in age between the daughters, I think there's about the, one of them, the eldest is 13 years older than the youngest daughter. And that spread in age meant the eldest one had quite a lot of time with her mother, and the youngest had almost no time with her mother. And you can really see the difference in their personalities as adults. The eldest one is very much like her mother. She is she's educated by her mother. The mother was, Eleanor of Castile was an extremely well-educated woman, and she clearly felt it was important to educate her daughters as well as her sons. And the younger daughter, who did not have the same advantages, is not as well-educated. So the elder daughter, we know, she could write, which was extremely rare. But, you know, that's the kind of advantage that having her mother's particular personalized interest gave her. But the younger daughter also, Elizabeth was her name, and she She clearly, there's a really strong sense that she was looking for that kind of maternal interaction for most of her life. And she did end up having a number of children herself. And I think that was probably something she felt was important.
Yeah, you mentioned Elizabeth there. The five that you focus on, Elizabeth, Mary, Margaret, Joanna, Eleonora. It's quite a challenge for a writer to distinguish between all those different women.
Yes, I mean, I think distinguishing between five, it's a difficult thing with any large number of people in that way, because obviously there are many things that they share in common with each other, particularly siblings. There are traits they will have in common. But one of the exciting things about this, doing the research for this book, was actually their kind of distinct personalities came through really strongly in the source material. I mean, Joanna is clearly fiery-tempered. Eleonora is clearly kind of dutiful and serious and statesmanlike. And you can see this in the way the small number of letters that they have, that they've written and that have survived, and in the what they're buying, what they're eating, where they're going, who they're writing to. This all still survives in these particularly wonderful wardrobe books, and that's really been, it was quite clear.
And the wardrobe books, we think of wardrobes as clothes, but they are far more revealing than that.
Yes, so it's the wardrobe books, particularly after the reign of Edward I. Before that, they really are just recording what's in the wardrobe, which is what we would think. But during the reign of Edward I, they decide to basically keep an account of all the purchases from the royal household within these books. And not all of them survive, but enough of them survive that we can really see in quite minute detail every single day. People are traveling from here to there. We can see where they're going, how many people they're going with. We can see what they bought to. We can see what their favorite foods were. Eleonora loved almonds. And we know this because she's constantly having almonds bought specifically for her.
Wow. It's really nice, isn't it? Something like that gives you a way into a person. It's so specific and real.
Mm, yeah.
Right. Well, we'll come up to more recent history now. We'll hear from Dr. Jonathan Fennell. He's a senior lecturer in defence studies at King's College London and a director of the Sir Michael Howard Centre for the History of War. His first book, Combat and Morale in the North African Campaign, was shortlisted for the Royal Historical Society's Whitfield Prize, runner-up for the Society for Army Historical Research's Templar Medal, and selected by BBC History magazine as one of the Books of the Year in 2011. His new book, Fighting the People's War, the British and Commonwealth Armies and the Second World War, has been described by Gary Sheffield, author of A Short History of the First World War, as outstanding and rich in insights. Drawing on new sources to reveal the true wartime experiences of the ordinary rank and file, it's a panoramic history of the citizens' armies of the UK, Australia, Canada, India, New Zealand and South Africa, the core of the British and Commonwealth armies in World War II. When I met Jonathan, I asked him why this subject.
Well, Cambridge asked me to write the book to start with. They wanted a book on the British Army in the Second World War, and I suggested, well, maybe we should look at the British and Commonwealth armies in their entirety, so a much bigger project. And I've always really been fascinated by the history of war and what you can learn about human beings by studying their conduct and experience in a highly pressurised environment. So I was naturally kind of inquisitive and was really quite delighted when I got the opportunity.
And the Commonwealth, you say there, the Commonwealth in the war was something different to the Commonwealth now?
Certainly the relationship of these kind of key countries with Britain was fundamentally different. They were much, much closer. So if we look at New Zealand, Australia, Canada, South Africa, we would have talked about them as dominions, intimately related with Britain, but their foreign policy was much more directed to a limited degree, by Britain than it is today.
And the responses across the Commonwealth were different then, presumably?
So mobilisation across the Commonwealth was different, you're quite right. So those countries, or those cohorts of the population in those countries that felt a closer connection with the mother country, were more inclined to sign up and fight this global war. English-speaking South Africans were more inclined to fight than Afrikaans-speaking South Africans. English-speaking Canadians are more inclined to fight than French-speaking Canadians. It makes a certain amount of sense. But it also meant that there were kind of cleavages across the Commonwealth. And although the narrative of the Second World War is often one of unity, of a band of brothers fighting against this tyranny, in fact, wars, and we should not perhaps be surprised by this, wars are destructive, painful, awful experiences. They tear communities to pieces. So the war was as much a struggle to hold the empire together as anything else.
And it's called armies. Of course, armies are made up of individuals. Did you get a real sense of the individuals within these platoons and troops?
I was so lucky. I found this miraculous series of sources, censorship summaries of the soldiers' mail. So the ordinary Tommy writes home to his mum or his girlfriend or his friends, and these letters are censored by the authorities and turned into weekly or bi-weekly reports. And I found 925 of these, and they were based on 17 million letters. I mean, so a vast resource. And I was able to engage with, yes, what the ordinary soldier felt, thought, believed. And the story is radically different from the one that we're used to, the Churchillian narrative. The soldiers wanted something a little bit different than Churchill, which is fascinating.
What did they want?
So if Churchill talked about maintaining the empire, Britain's greatness, its place in the world, geopolitics was of secondary significance to the ordinary man in this case. They wanted social change. They wanted something better as a consequence of their sacrifice. So they'd seen what had happened to their fathers in the First World War. There'd been no home fit for heroes. And they said, we're not going to let that happen a second time. So promise us, Churchill, a different world, and we will fight with all the energy in the world. The big part of the book is this friction, this dynamic between the soldier and the state, and the soldier asking for something and the state in most part saying, no, you can't have it. Churchill perhaps reasonably says, we'll talk about social change after the war. And this affects morale. And ultimately, it affects the politics of the soldiers, who vote overwhelmingly for Labour in 1945 and kick Churchill out.
So we do see the social change that they wanted, albeit with the change of government.
They recognise their agency, their power. They say, OK, if you won't give it to us, we have a franchise, we have a vote, and we will use it. It's quite fascinating how army education is brought in during the war, effectively a mass civics lesson for the whole of the British male population or young male population of the time. And that taught the soldiers how to manifest their beliefs in action, how they could use the vote to ensure that their political views were converted into reality. So the war politicizes the soldiers, and army education teaches them how to use it, and then they vote thus in 1945 in that famous landslide Labour victory.
Yes, because looking back on it from a perspective of somebody who wasn't alive at the time, it always seems slightly odd, given the status of Churchill these days, that when the war finishes and given the role he played, that then he's booted out.
I mean, the question has confounded historians for decades. I mean, it is one of the key debates in 20th century British history. Why? Why did the man, the greatest Briton of all time, as the narrative goes, get kicked out? The soldiers were quite clear. They said, great man for a battle. When it comes to peace, we need someone who has a closer affinity with the ordinary soldier, with the ordinary person. And Churchill was a man moved by great ideas, but he wasn't one of the masses, was he? And his inability, in a way, to kind of connect emotionally with the citizen soldier had implications on the battlefield, because soldiers often felt dissatisfied with what they'd been asked to fight for. And then it obviously had manifestations in terms of the vote. His inability to connect meant he alienated a big cohort of the voting population, and he got kicked out.
Was there something else about wanting to put the war behind them, and he was a memory of that?
It's quite interesting how this narrative comes out of the censorship summaries about dissatisfaction with the status quo, dissatisfaction with decades of Conservative government. And then, perhaps unfairly, to be honest, the Conservatives got blamed for a rushed election in 1945. The soldiers thought, well, can we not just hold on for a couple of months until we're all home and we've got our feet under the table again? And in many ways, the rushed election was partly Labour's creation, but they managed to blame the Conservatives. So all sorts of things went wrong for Churchill and right for the Labour Party in that epoch-defining election.
And reading those letters, how did that feel, actually reading the words of soldiers who'd been on the front?
It's like travelling back in time. You develop this connection with them as young men in this moment of national and international crisis, and you get a feel for how much they longed to be home with their loved ones and what was actually important. I mean, it's an amazing arena in which to study human beings. When you're under that type of pressure, when you're faced every day with meaning, what do they think? What do they think about their universe? How do they want their universe to be structured? And they talked about equality, they talked about fairness, they talked about a world where they felt agency, that they could connect with power. And in many ways, a lot of what we see today, the challenges that politicians are facing, is a desire by ordinary people to have a say. And so it's quite emotional, really, connecting with these mostly young men.
And it's a big book. Was it always intended to be a big book?
No. So any book, I suppose, is a great story in itself in terms of how it gets written. I started off thinking the book about great battles, and I stumbled across these wonderful sources that allowed me to tell a story of social change as well. So not only did these individuals fight for a country or an empire, but they changed those very societies that they were fighting war for in very profound ways. So the social change stuff came out as the project evolved.
And it took you 6 years to write. So how does it feel having it there now?
Goodness, I'm delighted. It's a long old time, and my two little kiddies were born in that period as well, so it's kind of accompanied me on these big journeys. I'm delighted to have it finished and to think about new things, but also very proud that I got the opportunity to engage with such a big question.
And writing, as you are, about a time of political tumult, it is a time of political tumult now. Is there anything we can learn?
Yeah, I think very much so. So the book is in large part about the need of the state, how the state needs ordinary people to survive and thrive. In the context of the Second World War, for the second time in a generation, the ordinary citizen had to stand up and defend the state. And when you alienate ordinary people, you have problems. So in some cases, the citizen soldier didn't fight with the type of intensity that was hoped for in the context of the Second World War. And in the last few decades, again, we've seen an increase in inequality, a disconnect at times between ordinary people and the state. And when that happens, people revolt. And you could argue that Brexit is a revolt of sorts, in the same way that desertion or AWOL or going sick in the Second World War was a form of protest. So I think, yes, there is a connection. You know, social justice, power has to be built on a bedrock of social justice, equality and fairness. And when you get that wrong, states can crumble very quickly.
And what was the most surprising thing that you learnt during your research?
I think it is this politicisation dynamic. Like many people, I'd rather assumed that soldiers tended to be right-wing, that the military inculcated those types of values. And when I looked at the voting statistics, the closer to combat soldiers were, the more left-leaning their votes were. So there was something about the experience of combat that was politicising soldiers. I guess when you're in a foxhole and you realise very quickly that you're reliant on the person to your left and your right and the person back in Birmingham or Bradford building weapons, the extent to which society is interconnected becomes really quite evident, powerfully so. So that surprised me, that dynamic, how war could radicalise so dramatically the ordinary citizen soldier.
You talked about you've had two children while you've been writing this. Did that make you feel differently about the soldiers who were away on the front? Because clearly some of them would have been fathers and had children.
I mean, it certainly helped to emotionally connect. I think that is one of the great things that historians must try to do, which is transport themselves into that period and try and understand the experience of individuals in their own time, in their own context. And that certainly was facilitated by wanting to see my little kiddies and then imagining what it must have been like to miss them and how deep that must have pulled at heartstrings. We think of the Second World War as a moment of clear and present danger, where everybody was willing to give up everything for the survival of the state. And then if you connect for 5 seconds with a young man, what is a young man thinking about? His loved ones, his family. And so we need to tell the story as it really was for you and me, ordinary people, not just through the lens of the great men and women, not just through Churchill's eyes, but through Tommy's eyes too.
And Fighting the People's War by Jonathan Fennell is published by Cambridge University Press. Listening to that with me on Bookmark today is Kelsey Wilson-Lee, here to talk about her book Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I. Kelsey, Jonathan talking there about transporting himself back in time and trying to put himself in the shoes of the men and women fighting. And you had to do that further back in time. It's quite challenging.
Yes, I mean, I think he's right that that is the kind of essential thing that all historians have to do. You have to try to do it in a way that is separated enough from yourself that you're trying to approach the subject on their own terms, as he said. And it's very difficult as a historian. One of the great difficulties as a historian is not allowing your own assumptions, your own perceptions about the world to focus what you're saying too much. It's inevitably going to happen a little bit, but you need to be really guarded. One of the things I was struck by that he was saying was talking about the way people were trying to defend the empire and defend and understand their world after the empire as it was kind of crumbling. I think it's really interesting because this book, my book, really starts at the beginning of the empire. And one of the stories I've tried to tell is that we think of empire building as a very male, you know, male-dominated enterprise. It's kings, it's soldiers. And actually, I think there are really interesting hidden stories of women participating. Obviously, the women soldiers and nurses and things like that who will have been in Jonathan's book, but also in this book, the women who were helping to make these diplomatic connections with counties and duchies across the Low Countries that were really designed, these connections, these alliances were really designed to help foster their fathers' ambitions to build an empire. I mean, this is the great age. This is why Edward I was conquering Wales. He's conquering, he wants to conquer Scotland. He then turns his sights on France, and you know, in the next, a couple generations later, Edward III, you've got these great, you know, the great battles of Crecy and Poitiers. You know, they're trying to build an English empire, and it's interesting because that's that same empire that eventually spreads across the world.
We'll come back to you in just a moment, Kelsey. We'll listen to your second choice of music now, which is a cracking track, this Maria by Blondie. Why this one?
I think this is a great song. This is one of my favourite songs. It's a really always puts me in a good mood. But fundamentally, I think it's interesting in this context because it's about a powerful woman whom men still want to control.
She moves like she don't care.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And we're here on Bookmark today with Kelsey Wilson-Lee talking about her book, Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I. Kelsey, we were touching on it before the music there, the role that women can play in diplomacy and politics. And they did this through intercession, this thing called intercession. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So intercession is basically means the using your influence, emotional or and also obviously the using your proximity to power to argue on behalf of others. So a queen might use intercession to speak to her husband offline about and say, actually, I really think you should, you know, it's basically advice, but it's advice that's often tinged with an emotional appeal. So we often have in the sources, there are instances in which some of these women are making particular pleas to their father, and sometimes they're about friends, sometimes they're about giving their favored servants particular grants. So a princess might say, please father, you know, give this particular servant a piece of land. He's been very good to me. And therefore, that servant, by virtue of this woman arguing on his behalf, has gotten some material wealth. Now, often that can be quite dry, but it can also be really, really kind of, they can really turn on the emotional kind of strings at some point. So we've got wonderful instances where women are getting down on their hands and knees in front of their husband, publicly begging him and saying, "As your wife, I beseech you." And it's this "as your wife," and they're really demanding that the emotional connection is important, and it works very well. And it was by this point in the late 13th century, this was kind of the standard way that royal women deployed a lot of their power. In that, and the kind of main example, one of the most important examples for intercession, is the Virgin Mary, who, of course, on the Day of Judgment, is seated next to Christ and helps him decide who gets to go to heaven forever and who gets cast into the inferno. So it's soft power, but it is a very, very real power. Murderers are pardoned. Vast amounts of land is given out. You know, all kinds of offices and different jobs are rewarded on the basis of intercession, female intercession.
Now, some of the other facts about their lives are almost quite shocking to modern readers. They were married or betrothed very young, sometimes 3-4 years old. I don't know whether those marriages were consummated. Mary was sent to a convent when she was, 12 years old?
She was sent to the convent originally at 6. She became a nun, a properly vowed nun at 12, which wasn't really meant to happen. I mean, the 6-year-old, it's rare to see a 6-year-old sent to a convent as a nun, as a novice. Normally, you were meant to be the canonical age of marriage, to either be married or to become a nun. The canonical ages of marriage were kind of the church's agreed minimum age at which you could be married. So for women, it was 12. For men, it was 14. Now, that is the age at which you are deemed to be kind of an able to give your consent. So most of these women were betrothed or engaged before that, long before that. Most of them did not, actually none of these women were married beneath that age. The youngest one to be married was 15, which is young, but not prepubescent. And actually several of them were not married until they were 18. One of them was 23. So it's not quite the kind of story of the child bride that is the kind of in the terrible image in the imagination. Even the ones that were married young or betrothed young, they normally didn't consummate these marriages until they were older. Actually, medieval contemporary treaties recommend waiting until 18 to consummate marriages. We know, because some children were born before those ages, that some people did consummate them before then. But often, as in the case of Eleanor of Castile, she may have had a child soon after her own marriage when she was about 13 that was terribly premature and didn't survive. But she didn't have any other children until she was almost 20. And so and then she went on to have this astonishing fertility. I think she had kind of 13 or 14 additional children. So she certainly was fertile. So the evidence suggests they consummated the marriage so that it couldn't be annulled, and then didn't cohabit in that way again until they were much older, which is, I think, actually slightly reassuring of it, on the whole.
Very reassuring. Thank you, Kelsey. We'll take a moment now to hear from Cathy Moore. The Cambridge Literary Festival kicks off on the 5th of April with a stellar lineup that includes Jill Dawson, Tracy Thorne, Jay Rayner and Ali Smith. The festival's now in its 17th year, and when I met its founder and director, Cathy Moore, I asked her if after 17 years it's easier to programme.
Yeah, it is actually. It's lots easier because publishers trust that we'll deliver audiences and that authors are treated very well here and they like to come back. So, yeah, it's much, much easier.
Yeah, you have got lots of authors returning, so that's a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a good sign. We've got loads of authors returning, and one which is giving me a particular amount of pleasure is that Helen Oyeyami is returning, and we had her as a debut writer, I can't remember how many years ago, but it was quite a few years ago, so it's excellent to see her doing so well and wanting to return.
So it's a very full and varied programme this year. How do you start when you're programming?
Lee, you say that as if it's never a full and varied programme.
It's always full and varied.
How do I start? Well, I guess we start with the issues that are going on in the world, and the publishers are very, very good at responding to those issues, so there are invariably several books which give a solid basis to that, and we build on that, and, you know, the publishers, of course, are always looking for new writers, established writers, and we get the catalogues and do kind of go through and see what's what, but after 17 years, you sort of know what the Cambridge audience likes.
Yes, the Cambridge audience is a very particular audience, isn't it?
Incredibly particular audience. You can't fob them off with anything that's a bit insubstantial. I mean, they like quality, they like issues, they like clever people, they like fabulous writers, you know, they like clever scientists. So, you know, they're a real pleasure to programme for.
So who have you got coming this year? Who are the big names?
We have George Monbiot, environmentalist. He's always a great favourite in Cambridge. And as you say, he's one of the people who has returned and returned. Tracy Thorne, likewise. She has publishing her memoirs this year. And again, I think this is probably her third visit. It sounds like we've got absolutely no originality at all. But we have. We have James O'Brien joining us, who's the LBC man leading Britain's conversation. I think that's a hugely highly anticipated event. Madeline Miller on her first visit, and she's actually only in the UK for a couple of weeks. She's written her amazing follow-up to The Song of Achilles, a book called Circe, which actually I enjoyed hugely. It's one of the few books that's actually made me clap because of the cleverness of it. The writing just sparkles off the page.
You have got a nice job, haven't you? You have to read lots of books and then meet writers.
Dirty job, somebody's got to do it. Yeah. No, it is. It's a great way to spend your time.
And it's a tumultuous time at the moment in politics. Does the programme reflect that?
People who are familiar with Cambridge Literary Festival and come back again and again kind of know that we always try to cover the key issues. And, of course, it is particularly baffling times, actually, that we find ourselves in just now. You know, the domestic situation is ridiculously complicated. It's like a banana republic, actually. I think that's what it's like at the minute. And I think that it's true to say this year we're the festival that is closest to D-Day, the March 29th exit of the European Union. I think we have three events, actually, which are probably going to be discussing Brexit in some form or other, you know, notably Hilary Benn, who is the brother of our patron, Melissa Benn. He's joining us to discuss the condition of British politics as it is, and, you know, no doubt we'll be touching on Brexit.
And pairing a chair and an author, how do you do that? Because the chair is so important to an event.
Oh yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because one of the things I love doing, really, is making, I think, what somebody once referred to as literary gin and tonics. And, you know, it is all about the mixer. It's all about the chemistry between the chair and finding somebody who is engaged and appropriate with the writer in question. And in Cambridge, we're hugely lucky is that we have a whole resource of people who are happy to join us. I mean, this year we've got people chairing like Alison Pearson, Rowan Pelling, David Runciman, you know, a whole host of chairs from across the city.
And is there a particular event that you're looking forward to?
It's always a difficult question because, one, I feel conflicted because there are so many events that I look forward to. I mean, I guess if I had to pick one, it would really have to be Ali Smith's, the third in her quartet series. So we're on to spring. That's one of the closing events on the Sunday, so I'm hugely looking forward to that.
You've got a team around you, an established team, all very confident, ensuring what they're doing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have three. There are three of us full-time currently, and this particular programme, actually, I, for the first time ever, had guest directors. So we had somebody programming the children's programme, and that's somebody called Sabina Edwards, and she's done a very good job on that. And then Alex Clark, who is familiar on the stage, actually, she comes and she's one of the wonderful chairs I was talking about, and journalist, and she has worked with me on the main programme this year.
And when you started it 17 years ago, could you have imagined that you would be here? Now you've got two offices and 17 years on, big names coming.
I've always had a huge lack of imagination, so it was a day at a time, and in some senses still it is. I've I mean, I'm delighted at where we've arrived. I mean, I'm delighted with the addition of the Wimpole History Festival, and have got ambitions to develop that further and to keep a good literary festival for the population of Cambridge and beyond, and, you know, work very hard to try and work with venues, box office, in order to present that in the most cost-efficient way possible.
And the Cambridge Literary Festival runs from the 5th to the 7th of April. If you want to find out more about it, go to the website cambridgeliteraryfestival.com. We've been talking today to Kelsey Wilson-Lee about her book Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Children of Edward I, which is published by Picador. We're coming to the end of our time with you, sadly, Kelsey. Just a quick question. The legacy of these women, can we see it today?
Yes, I mean, I think you can see, it's hard to see the legacy because unlike kings, very little survives of them that's in the public sphere. You can't go to Westminster Abbey and see a giant effigy of these women. And I think that's largely why they've been forgotten. But if you know where to look, there's a little bit of a legacy. There's a little bit of legacy here in Cambridge in the form of Clare College, which was founded by Joanna's daughter. And that there's a little pane of glass in the upstairs that you can see in the upstairs of Clare College window that has a shield and says Joanna of Acre. And I think that's a really interesting legacy because it's about women and education. And if there's anything about these women that really kind of shouts out at me is that they, everything about the way they interacted with their world was about education and about how they had been taught about their role in their family, their role in society, their role on an international stage, and about the power that they had, which came through their learning. And the fact that that Joanna's daughter, who's called Elizabeth, they all unhelpfully named yes. all of their daughters the same names as these same girls.
They all named their children after the other sisters, didn't they?
There's about 18 Eleonoras and 15 Joannas, so it gets a bit confusing. But Elizabeth, who founded Clare College, was the first woman to found any of the Oxbridge colleges. And actually, her friend and cousin went on to found Pembroke College, and then all the different Queen's Colleges, all of these things, and Margaret Beaufort's foundations in centuries later. These all kind of stem from that role of women, particularly royal and very elite noble women who had had money to spend and wanted to spend it on building programs that were about education. And I think that's a powerful legacy. And I think they'd be thrilled to know that many centuries after they founded these, women are also being educated in these colleges. And I think that's a great way to end.
Thank you, Kelsey. And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
I am about halfway through Rupert Thompson's wonderful examination of the lives of these extraordinary surrealists, Claude and Marcel, which is called Never Anyone But You. It's absolutely, like everything he writes, it's absolutely stunningly written, but it's also a really interesting kind of psychological portrayal of real people in a kind of fictionalized environment who are women who are kind of in the early 20th century kind of exploring the limitations of gender and really trying to push beyond those.
Thank you, Cass. We'll come back to you in just a moment to get your final choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, we were looking at the lives of others theme. We're continuing this theme, really. Our studio guest is Jill Dawson. She's talking about her new novel, The Language of Birds, inspired by the Lord Lucan Affair. We'll also hear from Whitney Shara, who's written The Age of Light, a debut novel about the photographer Lee Miller and her relationship with Man Ray. And we'll hear from local life writer Kay Blaney, who's written The Mill Road Monologues, bringing to life the people of the past who lived and worked on Mill Road in Cambridge. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Kelsey. This is Feeling Good by Nina Simone. Why this one?
I think this is a wonderful, strong woman voice, and it's a really universal perspective. And I'd like to think that anyone, even these women very far back in time, have felt like this.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel.
Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, and I'm feeling.